You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
There are not many hopeful stories coming out of the Middle East these days. So Sandy Tolan's remarkable new book, Children of the Stone, The Power of Music in a Hard Land, is timely and welcome. It is a story of change. It's a story of possibility. Tolan tells the unlikely story of Ramzi Hussein Aberwedwan, who grew up in a Palestinian refugee camp under Israeli military occupation. Ramzi's first glimpse of a bigger world comes in the wake of the Oslo Accords, when tens of thousands of Palestinians long exiled by Israel came home. One of them was Mohammed Fadel, a violinist trained in musical therapy. It was Fadel, co-founder of the Palestine National Conservatory of Music, who first asked the shy young Ramzi, "What would you like to learn to play?" He takes up the viola. The story of Ramzi's journey from a rock-throwing boy to an accomplished musician who studies at a conservatory in France and who realizes a dream of founding a music school for Palestinian children is a stirring tale indeed. We learn how Daniel Barenboim, the Israeli conductor and music director of the Berlin State Opera, is also inspired by Ramzi's story. He invites him to play in his West Eastern Divan Orchestra, where the young Palestinian meets Israelis as fellow musicians rather than as soldiers. Music, by its very nature, creates harmony. Ramzi's story in Children of the Stone is a testament to the power of music to transcend a vast political divide. It is a tale that proves the famous words of Margaret Mead: "Never doubt that a group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Ramzi's story is chronicled with great artistry and with painstaking reporting by Sandy Tolan, who is also the author of The Lemon Tree, An Arab, a Jew, and the Heart of the Middle East. Tolan is co-founder of Homeland Productions and has produced dozens of radio documentaries for NPR and PRI. He was a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University and an I.F. Stone Fellow at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He is now Associate Professor at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at USC. In conversation with Sandy tonight is NPR correspondent Kelly McEvers. Kelly previously ran NPR's Beirut Bureau, where she earned many awards, including a George Foster Peabody Award for her 2012 coverage of the Syrian conflict. She recently made a radio documentary about being a war correspondent with renowned radio producer Jay Allison. And in 2008 and 2009, she was part of a team that produced the award-winning Working series for American Public Media's business and finance show Marketplace. Please welcome Sandy Tolan and Kelly McEvers to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library.
Thank you so much for coming. Really glad to have you here. We're going to talk to Sandy for a little while, and then we would love to hear from you afterwards. I have to say, I don't want to embarrass you, but I tell this story many times, and I just told it to you for the first time tonight. Sandy's pretty much the reason I work in radio.
I didn't know.
Yeah, he's like, are you sure that's okay? I saw him give a speech in Flagstaff, Arizona, where you had spent a lot of time as a reporter.
Yeah, I went to school there for years. Yeah,
and lived there. Doing some reporting on the Navajo reservation there and reporting on the Mexican border there. And I remember him giving a speech about the power of radio and the power of listening and the power of story. And it was something that really stuck with me. as a young journalist trying to figure out my way in the world. So for better or for worse, for better or worse, thank you for doing that to me.
Thank you, Kelly.
I'll never get rich as a public
radio journalist.
I didn't
say anything about a path to
Right, you did not, no.
I don't think so.
As a public radio journalist, but I did fall in love with this idea that that telling stories can be a life, can be a way of life. Mm-hmm. So with that, I thought we could delve into this story, this really powerful story. And I want to start where so many good stories begin, which is in an Italian restaurant. I know, but I talk to students sometimes, they say, where do you find your stories? I say, in the most, you know, just sort of everyday places sometimes, right?
Yeah.
In a taxi or in a restaurant. But for you, this story in some ways doesn't begin, but it really kind of takes off in 2009
right.
in an Italian restaurant. Can you take us there?
Yeah,
and tell us about
December.
That?
It was sort of by chance. I was with a couple of former Berkeley students, and now I'm at USC, but I was teaching at Berkeley at the I had come down here, but they were former Berkeley students. They were working, one of them, Ben Hubbard, with the New York Times now, and another journalist, and we said, we couldn't find the restaurant we wanted to go to, and all of a sudden we walked in, and we to this place called Pronto, which is an Italian restaurant in Ramallah, and all of a sudden, you know, in the corner of the room, I hear, this, Sandy. And I look, and there's this guy he's grown a beard, and he's smiling at me. And I'm like, who is that? And he points to him and goes, Ramsey. And this was someone that I hadn't seen in 10 or 12 years. I had met him when he was 18 years old, did a piece for NPR around the time I was researching what became the Lemon Tree radio documentary and then book. But there were these posters all around Ramallah at the time, and back in 98 when he was 18, showing a young Ramsey with a stone in his hand, and at age 8, one of the children of the stones, the kids trying to expel the military occupation of Israel from the refugee camp where he grew up with his grandparents who raised him. And next to that, in that the same poster, was a picture of this young man, this 18-year-old, playing the viola. And it was such a captive, and you know how, you know, as a journalist, you're like,
what
I have to tell the story.
Right, what is it?
Who is
it? Who is that?
You know?
What's the phone number?
So,
right,
exactly. So we went to the refugee camp, we were at Al-Amri refugee camp near Ramallah, and I did this long feature for NPR, probably 17, back in the day when, you know, it wasn't that long of a piece, 17 minutes. he was like such a charming, incredibly energetic guy, and I thought, oh, wow, I remember asking him, like, what do you want to do? He's like, I want to play in the first national orchestra of Palestine, and I want to start a music school for the children of Palestine. I'm like, wow, what a dream for this 18-year-old who lives in a refugee camp with his grandparents, right? Then he gets this scholarship to study in France, and he stays there for 7 years. Coincidentally, my brother lives about 15 miles from the school where he went. So I used to go visit my brother, and I would check in on Ramsey. But then after a couple of years, I just kind of lost track until that day in the restaurant. And then I'm like, Ramsey, you know, and in the Arabic style, you kiss each other's cheeks. I'm like, what are you doing?
Three times, two times.
Yeah,
you never
right.
know how many
Sometimes
times.
Four, you know.
Yeah, right.
And
depending
Ramsey,
on how excited you are.
Join us at the table. And I said, what are you doing? He goes, oh, I'm starting music schools for the children of Palestine. I'm like, wow. I mean, and I just, you know, I got chills, and I kept grabbing his arm. I'm like, Ramsey, you did it. You did exactly what you said you would do. And he said, well, why don't you come by tomorrow? And 5 years later, here I am.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Was it at that moment that you thought to yourself, I mean, you knew, I'll probably do another story about this, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Follow-up story
Pretty quick.
That you wanted to do.
And I did. I did a little essay, basically retelling the story I just told you.
For NPR.
For NPR 2010. Yeah.
Last night. And I don't know, I guess at what point were you then like, actually, this should be a book?
It took a little while. You know, I wasn't sure. I had a few other kind of a personal story I was going to tell, and I tried to get traction. I had this idea of doing a book about the 75th anniversary of the Hoover Dam, and I started researching it until I found out someone else was writing that book. Oops, there goes that idea. And I'm glad that it went by the wayside. And then all of a sudden, you know, I actually had dinner, I think, with a friend of mine, a reporter, Mark Shapiro, up in Berkeley, and I was telling him the story. He goes, that sounds like a book. I said, yeah, I was thinking maybe. You think? Yeah, are you kidding? And then, you know, then all of a sudden I thought, and then I talked to editor, agent, and I started getting excited about it. And so then, one of the things that, as you know, I mean, it's hard to do anything long form, much less a book, if you don't have cooperation. So I approached Ramsey and I said, I think we have a chance to do something that would really illuminate the experience for children living in Palestine and tell a different kind of story than the one that people are so familiar with. And he really was agreeable, and he understood that this was not going to be like a promotional book. I mean, right. I think people will like Ramsey and like what he's done, but like it had to be an independent journalistic enterprise, and he got that, and then he realized that he had a chance to really tell his story and his history, and he trusted me with it, which is like a huge thing, as you well know yourself,
right.
Kelly.
It's everything. And so what the book does next is really take us back and start to tell us his story from the beginning. Mm. And what it's like to live in a refugee camp with his grandparents. Mm. I guess when we say refugee camp, you know, that conjures up certain images for me and probably
right.
for you too, you know, tents, people living in. But in the Palestinian territories, a refugee camp is a different thing. Can you describe it for
yeah.
us where he lived?
Yeah, I mean, they started out that way. I mean, when people talk about being a refugee, a Palestinian refugee, it basically means you're from a family, a second, sometimes third, now fourth generation of the dispossessed Palestinians of 1948, when Israel was created. Of course, Israelis generally call that moment in history that our War of Independence. The Palestinians, or independent historians, will generally say it's the War of 1948 or the First Arab-Israeli War. Palestinians call it the Nakba, the catastrophe. And that's when 750,000 Palestinians either fled the war or were driven out by the Israeli army. And so the grandparents, including Ramsey's grandparents, came from a little village called Nani, which along with some 400 other villages either has been converted or more often destroyed because Israel doesn't want the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, now millions, if you count their descendants, to return. That's one of the big bones of contention of the entire dispute, the entire sort of tragedy between Israel and Palestine. So there are refugees under the United Nations. Their status is refugees. But if you go there, it looks more like a slum, most of them. There are places, you've probably been to the camps near Beirut, Sabra, yeah. Shatila, very, very grim places where you see overhead just knots of wires and just trash in the streets, and it's a tough way to grow up. And Al-Amri, where Ramsey grew up, was not nearly as grim as some of the Lebanese camps, mm-hmm. but they're slums. You see people, you know, there's rebar sticking out of the roofs and houses sort of patched together. They started as huts and tents, and then they went to like mud and plaster, and now there's some actually fairly nice ones. So the streets, you went from dirt. There's a little bit of concrete now, but it's a tough place, and it's in some of the camps, not so much Al-Amri, a place of real militancy as well, I mean, partly bred by poverty and a sense of dispossession, wanting to go home and not being allowed to, home as perceived even by the great-grandchildren of the original refugees.
Right, and this is something that you hear over and over again from people living in these camps, and it's this story that lives with people who, like Ramsey,
yeah.
he never went to this village, Nani.
No.
He was never there, but he heard about it
right.
from
and
the
you,
grandparents. And
you
everybody
could swear.
Hears about it
right.
from the grandparents. Everybody's got there's the story, right? It seems like whenever you encounter a family, you encounter the story of where they came from.
Absolutely. Right? And it's like every generation, like the tangerines or the apricots get larger and sweeter, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, I remember in Lebanon going to a refugee camp, I think it might have been Sabra or Shatila, and people talking about, oh, yeah, I draw a map for my grandchildren of the village. But the village hasn't existed in 50, 60, 70 years, right? And the kids memorize, oh, this is Mr. Abed's auto shop or the grocery or the mosque. And so there's this, I did a piece once for a public radio site that you know called Transom, called The Imaginary Village. And it was all about this sort of romancing and fantasy of a place that where people live in the past, where it was a certain way, and in the future of when they're going to return, or so they wish.
And for Ramzi, it's interesting, too. His parents were married very young. They had very tough times. His mother wasn't in the picture. His father was later not in the picture. Mm. So he's basically raised by his grandparents. So there's no layer of that other generation between him and the generation that remembers, that's living in this nostalgic world, right?
That's really true. You know, that's a very good point. And he just, you know, revered his grandfather. In fact, near the beginning of the book, he one of the first stories he told me, and I kept re-reporting it and getting all the details, like he snuck out of bed at 5 years old and followed his grandfather to work. His grandfather was a municipal refuse worker. He was basically a garbage man. And he would go around and empty the cans. And Ramzi followed him to work and crossed like this big road by himself. And he popped out from behind a wall and said, Sido, you know, my grandfather, Sidi, hi. And he's like, what are you doing here? And then he convinced his grandfather to let him stay. And then he became like garbage man's assistant for, you know, for 5 years old. And he's like going through. And so he learned the sort of value of work. And he said, you know, my grandfather was like, you know, your work isn't garbage, but he was like, the work was holy to him. And he learned the ethos of like really hard work and also this sort of romance of the place that his grandparents were expelled from.
Right, right. So he was spending so much time, he always heard the story. When and how did music come into Ramzi's life?
Well, a couple of ways. One was, I asked him all about this, and one of was, he had a teacher when he started going to school, maybe first, second grade, named Teacher Haladi. And he was one of these teachers that the kids just love. And he said, we went running to school for Mr. Haladi, Teacher Haladi, they called him, Teacher Haladi. And one day, Teacher Haladi opened this cabinet and started distributing, you know, maracas and tambourines and tablas to the kids. And then he pulled out a violin. And as Ramzi describes it, you know, his face was transformed and he became a kamanjati, a violinist. Not coincidentally, Ramzi's school today is called Al Kamanjati, the violinist. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the beginning, but he actually got a chance to really play when this middle-class Palestinian woman who had kind of befriended him and almost not really adopted him, but she at the time didn't have kids, she was not married, and his mother, as you said, had essentially abandoned the family. It's a complicated story. And they became very close, and then she saw an opportunity when there was going to be, as Maureen was describing in the beginning, all these people came back. Mohammed Fadl came back from exile in Jordan and helped start this conservatory. And this woman said, you know, Mohammed, we cannot, her name was Sarayda. Sarayda said, we cannot just have this school for the elites. We've got to have kids, refugee kids, poor kids. And he's like, well, do you have any ideas? Who? And he's like, yes, I do. And there you know, before you know it, Ramzi is studying the viola. And all of a sudden, he's like, this is what I want. And he's a very smart guy. He also saw this as a path for him to have another life.
Right. And I like this story. There's a great story about why he's playing the viola and not the violin. Which teacher was it that said, it's a size thing, right?
Yeah, you got big hands. and we also already have violinists.
Right, right, right.
So it's like a viola. It's like a violin. It's just bigger.
It's just bigger, right?
So it'll work better for you. For that, he became a violist.
For your hand. Yeah. And so, I mean, he eventually does. I mean, it is a path to something different, right? He eventually is able to study in France. I mean, he gets basically a scholarship, right? Someone pays for him to go study in France.
Yeah, and the scholarship... Oh, sorry.
I guess my question is, you know, for some people living in such tough conditions, you would think that this is the pathway out, and you'd sort of go and never look back. Right. But it seems like he did not think that way at all from the beginning, did he?
I don't think he did. I mean, when I met him, he hadn't been to France yet. Mm-hmm. He had been to America to something called Apple Hill, which was a music camp that brought Israelis and Jordanians and Palestinians and other peoples in conflict together to play music in the summer. And that's when he got inspired about the idea. But he had never been anywhere else, essentially, outside of the West Bank and maybe Jordan. And so he got this idea, but when he went to France, he had already mentioned to me and had in his head, I want to start this music school. Right. I want to be in the first, Palestine National Symphony. And when I interviewed extensively many times his viola teacher, this guy Francois, in France, he said, I felt like he could have really been even though he only started playing at age 16 or 17, he said he really could have played in European symphonies, or he could have had a career as a violist here. But he was also playing Arabic music all the time in the bouzouk. And Francois said, I think he had it in his head all the time that his future was back there.
Right.
And he knew. He did know that.
Right, which is really interesting, because I think there are a lot of young Palestinians who have the chance maybe to go.
Right.
They're probably going to do it. But, you could just sense there was this, he just had this mission and that he was going to to stick to it. At some point, Ramzi's story intersects with that of Daniel Barenboim and Edward Said's project, right? Which was the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. Am I saying that right?
That's right.
Okay. This is well, tell us what that is and tell us sort of how his story intersects with
that. Well, it started, well before Ramzi ever met Daniel Barenboim, and he never did actually meet Edward Said, who died in 2003. But Edward and Daniel met by chance in line to check in at the Hyde Park Hotel in London. And as Daniel and Edward's widow Miriam tell me, basically, Edward said, "Oh, are you Edward? Yeah. I'm just reading Cultural Imperialism. Oh, I have tickets to the symphony you're conducting tonight in London as a guest conductor. We should get together and talk. According to Daniel, they spoke every day for the rest of Edward's life, and they became what Daniel Barenboim said called intellectual soulmates. And Daniel more as a musician and an artist, but he said, Edward was a very talented pianist, and he reviewed opera for The Nation magazine, which a lot of people don't know.
Yeah,
and they identify him mostly as this cultural commentator. Literary critic, and of course, fierce defender of the rights of his people, the Palestinians. But they both had this sort of desire, coming from somewhat different political perspectives, to create something new. And Edward was already fed up with the Oslo process. He didn't think it was going to bring peace and justice to his people, or to the Israelis, for that matter, either. And Daniel was probably not quite that far along in the way that Edward was thinking about Oslo, but they both wanted to create something different. And around that time, it was the 250th anniversary of Goethe in Weimar, where Goethe lived, and that one of his series of poems was called The West Eastern Divan. And Edward Said loved that because he felt like this was not an Orientalist, as he would have said. This was someone who actually was a Westerner who was curious about the other. So they named their orchestra for that. And in the first year, they sent invitations out to Israelis, Egyptians, Jordanians, Palestinians. Ramzi was in Angers studying at the time, and he got an invitation by fax, and he takes this in to his teacher, to Francois. He goes, I've got this fax from this fellow Barenboim. Do you know who he is?
Heard of it?
And Francois goes, you get invited by Barenboim? This is ridiculous. You are not ready for this. And for that reason, he didn't join, and he finally did meet Barenboim in the West Bank, as Barenboim has been very involved with Palestinians. And finally, Barenboim met him and invited him personally, and Ramzi joined for 4 years. there were differences, political differences, although the two of them remain, you know, deeply respectful and affectionate toward each other. And that's sort of a story that's explored in the book.
Yeah, well, I think we'll talk about those differences a little bit because I think it's interesting. But first, one of the more surprising things I think about this orchestra, I think we all think we know the story about it, and there's some really great surprises in the book. And one of them was it's not an orchestra of Israelis and Palestinians. That's sort of the sense that you always have, right? It's Israelis and Palestinians playing together. But it's not that. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, it's Israelis and various people from different parts of the Arab world. Egypt, even Turkey, which is really not the Arab world. Iraq, Syria, Jordanians, and a few Palestinians. Ramzi, for a while, was the only or one of two Palestinians who actually grew up under occupation. And this is where the sort of the foundation of some of the differences came, because at one point, one of the cellists is an Israeli who grew up in a settlement.
Oh, yeah, that's and, a thing and, I want you to read, actually.
Yeah.
Would you mind reading that
passage? No, not at all.
I would love
Do you have the
you
page
did.
Number?
Yeah, it's page 224.
So this guy is named Kirill, and Ramzi had a problem with this.
The last paragraph on page 224.
Okay, so this is when they were in Salzburg for a music festival with the Divan, and this is, I think, the third summer that Ramzi was playing with the Divan. After the performance, the orchestra and distinguished guests of the Salzburg Festival were dining in a palatial banquet hall at large round tables covered by light white linen, when Ramzi spotted an open chair next to Kirill Zlotnikov, a gifted cellist who was originally from Minsk, Belarus. Around the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union, Kirill and his family became part of the wave of Jewish migration to Israel. They settled in Gilo, on land captured by Israel during the 1967 war. Israel considered Gilo to be a neighborhood or suburb, part of greater Jerusalem, just north of Bethlehem. Gilo, however, was built in part on lands seized from the nearby Palestinian villages of Bet Jala, Bet Safa, and Sharafat. Under international law, Gilo was considered an illegal settlement. Kirill, who was already a prodigy when he left the former Soviet Union, arrived in Gilo in 1991 when he and Ramzi were both 12 years old. The two boys grew up 10 miles apart. A few weeks earlier, Ramzi had heard that Kirill was from Gilo. He had been waiting for a chance to confront him. He pulled up a chair at the large banquet table. "I don't understand how come somebody like you can live in a settlement," Ramzi said. Kirill was taken aback. He did not expect to be questioned like this in the middle of dinner after such a performance. "I just thought it was an inappropriate moment for him to start accusing me," Kirill remembered. This is when I interviewed Kirill. I've got from both of their perspectives. He told Ramzi, "Let's talk about it later. Everybody's so happy. The concert is finished. Let's have a good dinner." The entire table had fallen silent. Musicians and Austrian dignitaries were staring in surprise at the two young men. Ramzi pressed on. "You are actually creating a problem for coexistence. How can you believe in the settlements and participate in such a project as the Divan?" Kirill explained that his parents had arrived poor from Russia 20 years earlier, six people with a total of $900, and were given a cheap house in Gilo. "You know why it's cheap?" Ramzi said. "Because it's on stolen land." Kirill, like many Israelis, believed that Gilo, despite its being built on Palestinian land, was, quote, an integral part of Jerusalem. "We got used to it," Ramzi recalled Kirill saying. "It's comfortable for us now." "I don't understand," Ramzi replied sarcastically. "You waited 3,000 years to come back to the promised land, but you can't change after 20 years?"
That's good. So, you know, this is supposed to be this project that's about, you know, kind of intellectually exploring togetherness through music, and here is Ramzi being very confrontational. He sounds like he could be a real pain in the, you know, sometimes.
He felt like, I mean, it exists on several levels. I mean, on one, you know, as a member of the audience or as many members of the press or people who just come, if you see Israelis and Arab musicians, Israeli musicians and Arab musicians walking on stage together in Germany playing Beethoven with a Jewish Israeli conductor, I mean, it sends chills, right? But then if you also are a Palestinian who's grown up under occupation and the Divan Orchestra, despite Daniel Barenboim's very courageous political stands in which he accepted a national prize by talking about the occupation, you know, much to the dismay and anger of his the people who were awarding him this Wolf Prize in Jerusalem, Israeli prize. I mean, he did not, Daniel would not go so as far as to say, yes, as an orchestra, we are willing to make the statement that we don't believe in the occupation. And Ramsey felt like, how can you then be in favor of my freedom? I mean, I can see it from both of their perspectives. And Ramsey finally, after 4 years, said, I can't convince them. And the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement was growing. And I think that contributed to Ramsey's sense that I can't justify staying in this orchestra if they won't take a stand, as far as I see it, in favor of my people's freedom.
And so Ramsey really turns his attention toward this school that he's always wanted to found. He does so in old Ramallah. He chooses an old building. You've been there, of course.
Many times.
Tell us about it. What does it look like when he first encounters it, and how does
Well, you know, it's funny. He actually had Al-Kamanjati going for a few years, and I think in a way it was like good for him to just focus on this because he's always running around. He's performing different bands and so on. I came the first time in December of 2009, and the next summer is when he came back and decided not to go back to the Divan. But there's something really magical about this place because it is so physically beautiful. It's these architects who've basically rethought what they call Ramallah Tata, old Ramallah, and it's an old part of the city, but a lot of it had been neglected and run down, and they basically reimagined it. And you walk in and it's this gorgeous courtyard with gleaming stones, and you hear people playing, you know, the drums over here, and there's a piano, and there's a voice teacher over there, and then there's music, the violin music, and so it's a place that people just go, and they go, when they come. And that, and then he didn't just want it to be a school, he wanted it to really be a kind of musical presence, to have summer camps, and to have, workshops. They have a Baroque festival every December. European musicians and American musicians come and they teach and they play and perform with the Palestinian kids. And then there's Arabic ensembles that are a very big part of the school. And a lot of it is all sort of focused around the idea of, as Ramsey put it, protecting the kids, protecting them from the sense of this occupation, this military occupation that's all around them.
Explain that a little bit. What does he mean by that?
How does
music protect you from a military occupation?
Yeah. It's funny because, at first when he said that, I want to protect these children from these soldiers, I'm thinking, well, Ramsey's very savvy. He's very media savvy. I mean, that's a really good soundbite, But what does it mean, actually, right? And so in the course of this, I did some research, and I had this wonderful researcher who's actually my niece, who did a lot of fact-checking and research, and she found this book, and, looking through the whole range of people in conflict zones like Bosnia, South Africa, Northern Ireland, whether it's neurologists, sociologists, musicologists, looking at how music is not only, and this is what the kids were telling me, not only protective of the kids in the moment that they're playing music, and teachers were telling me this too, and I saw it myself, but it's also a way of giving people a sense of their own dignity and self-respect. And, Rasha, who's the big sister of the girl Ala, who is the first student at the school who's on the cover of the book, Ala Shalalda, Rasha, would tell me these things about how music, especially playing Bach, the Partita and Sonata number 2 arranged for flute, like this gave me a feeling of just being happy. And people would say, Rasha turned from this sort of angry child who was traumatized during the Israeli incursions in the second more violent Palestinian Intifada in 2002 and around those years. Suddenly was this self-respecting child who used music as protection, in fact. Yeah.
Right. Tell us a little bit more about that family. There's a brother and 2 sisters. They're from old Ramallah. Ramsey meets them, right, when he's just putting the school
together. Yeah, he's the school was basically a dump. It had literally been used as a dump by the municipality, and it was just, there was rubble and strewn, and the kids used to like sweep up these old abandoned rooms, Rasha and Allah and some of the neighborhood kids, and they would play house, you know, as kids do, as girls do, and they played house, and one day this guy shows up, you know, with some foreigners, and they're like, you know, they didn't trust him. Like, what do you want? They thought he was a businessman. And he says, do you want to learn music? And they're like, nah, we're not going to learn any music. And Allah was like very wary because she had just gone through the Second Intifada. She was only 6 or 7 at the time. But then, you know, one day she just kind of, right after Al-Kamajati opened and Ramzi really didn't have he didn't have any students at the time. And she kind of wandered in and said, oh, you know, he was playing the viola, and he said, why don't you come, and what do you want to play? And she's like, I want to play the violin. And he's like, well, you know, it's a lot of dedication. You know, that's a lot of work. He goes, I don't care. It'll be hard at first, but I will make it. And then her sister decided to play the flute. First she played the oud, and then she played the flute. And then the brother wasn't really into... He started on the oud and got into a big fight with one of his teachers, and he was very angry. He was an angry kid. And Ramzi saw that he was really good with his hands, so he started to put him to work laying stone and putting up the walls for the school, and then he ended up being the fix-it guy. And then Ramzi's like, you know what? I bet I could get him involved in this instrument-making workshop. And now Shahada, the big brother, is the instrument maker and repairman of Al-Kamajati.
He actually goes to Italy and learns how to make a violin, makes one for his sister.
Yes.
That he signs and then puts the flag of Palestine inside. Yeah. That is one of the most unbelievably moving.
And thank you.
That, and when the rest of the sisters get a chance to go to Italy.
Yeah.
And these are people who are living in a world of, and we'll talk about this a little bit more too, but living in a world of constant checkpoints, constant surveillance. I mean, you know, there's no such thing as freedom of movement in the occupied territories. I mean, you know, you want to go, you know, from here to there as the crow flies, it might be a few miles, but what it can take, you've done it yourself many, many, many times. It can take you hours, right?
Right. I mean, you could take, if you could drive from, say, Ramallah to Bethlehem on a straight shot, you'd go through Jerusalem and take you about half an hour.
Right.
But you have to go around on what they call Wadi al-Nar, the fire road, and you go around and down through, and there are checkpoints. And sometimes it takes, you could make it in an hour and a half, sometimes more, right, depending on the checkpoints. There are more physical barriers in the West Bank than most people would imagine. I mean, it varies between 500, 600, sometimes 700 checkpoints, roadblocks, earthen barriers, other restricted things that restrict access. This is in a land, the West Bank, that's half the size of Connecticut.
Right.
So the sense of restriction and the sort of steaming feeling that people get waiting at checkpoints and idling in their cars. And sometimes there's signs that allow the settlers to go through on one lane and the Palestinians have to wait. And one time Ramzi actually went through. I was with him when he went through the settlers. And he's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I want to know, are Israeli babies and Palestinian babies, are they the same? He goes, what are you talking about? He goes, and he has his baby in the back seat. And the settler looked, and he probably saw me too, but he looked, and there was Ramzi's wife with their little one-year-old with his soccer jersey with a number one on it. And they just waved him through. But this is sort of the feeling that people, I mean, the checkpoint is the kind of central reality for Palestinians living under occupation.
600 checkpoints in a place smaller.
Yeah, not all checkpoints, but there are various obstacles.
And then
obstacles,
there's things that the kids call flying checkpoints, which can just happen anytime. You're just driving down the road, flying checkpoint, one will just pop up. And imagine being these kids from this family and being able to go into this courtyard and sort of escape all of that.
Right.
And then get a chance to go to Italy, which they did, right, with the school.
Right.
And there's just this great little passage, if you'll read it, on page 233,
yeah,
the second to the last paragraph.
Yeah, I mean, these kids spent so much time, and you know, Israel says this is for security, and this is for making sure that militants aren't evading the fixed checkpoints. But for the kids, it's just a reminder and a sense of humiliation. So you want me to start at this in
where
the summer?
Where it says the children were performing in village squares, yeah.
In 233?
233, yeah. Second to last paragraph.
The children were performing in village squares, making friends along the way. A Palestinian gelato shop owner had treated the family, refusing their money. At the Piazza della Signora in Florence, the kids gaped at marble statues from the Renaissance period, naked in struggle. In another square, Allah froze, nervous and trying not to laugh, while pigeons landed at her head and arms, and her father snapped photos. For Allah, the freedom of movement in Italy was jarring. One day, riding toward the Mediterranean coast, she asked her father, Baba, which means daddy, why aren't we being stopped? They were in a rental car heading towards Naples. Allah was confused. Nowhere could she see checkpoints, jeeps, or Humvees. Habibti, Nabil replied softly. Darling, this is Italy. This is not Palestine.
And these are people, right, who don't, you know, I mean, there's, you can't go to Jerusalem, you can't go to the sea. I mean, there's a whole big part of your country that you cannot go to. I mean, this is their reality, right?
They don't
understand another reality.
Yeah, and so many Palestinian kids, I mean, Jerusalem used to be in the early part of Oslo and before Oslo, Jerusalem was quite accessible by comparison to now. Now you have to have permits. Even kids have to have permits. Jerusalem is becoming a kind of imaginary city. The sea, you have to pass through Israel proper. So to get a permit to go there is equally difficult, if not more difficult, even though Gaza, where they were supposed to, under Oslo, you're supposed to have a corridor and be able to pass to Gaza from the West Bank. That's never been realized. It's never gotten that close, as far as I can tell. So, you know, people have grown up with the sea and Haifa and Gaza and Aqqa and all of these places, and they just, again, they just hear about it. They don't know, and they like, sometimes high up you can see the sea. If you're on a hilltop, you can see the sea glistening in the distance, but you can't touch it.
Wow. Speaking of seeing, let's maybe look at some photos now. I thought it would be nice. We've sort of talked about some of these characters to see what they look like.
Yeah, so and Russell, could you? Oh, good.
Yeah,
thank you.
Great.
Okay, so this is, I think we can sort of go right through some of these because we've already become familiar. This is Ramzi, taken by a photographer named Keith Dannemiller back in probably 1988 when Ramzi was 8 or 9, throwing a stone in the camp. A triptych. This is Ramzi. You see the boy on the red coat. It's probably a year or two later, the little faux fur collar. This is the camp. This is they used to pull these stones up to try to keep the Israeli jeeps from coming during the first Intifada. There's the poster I was telling you about. Al-Kamajati wasn't what it was said before. It was an advertisement for the Palestine National Conservatory. There's Ramzi near the beginning of the time when he was experimenting with the idea of the school. He's probably 25 or so in this picture. This is, I think, in the camp. This is him with some of the kids. See this girl in the background. She's not sure what to make of him. Who is this guy? You know, and this is, you know, oh my God, what's this? They don't know what some of these instruments are. Most of these images are in the book themselves. I mean, this is an image of confinement taken a few years ago. Women waiting to go pray at Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Those are soldiers there. This is back in 2005. A French woman who was named Jessie, who's now an opera singer in Philadelphia.
Really?
In fact, I'm going to Philadelphia on this tour and probably gonna meet her and my niece, who's also there. She's got an amazing voice, and she's very, very, got very, very involved in the school for a while. There's Ramzi playing for his grandparents, probably 2008, in the refugee camp. So as you can see, as you said, you know, these are not, you know, I mean, people live in some dignity. It's not like everybody's living. And there's Ramzi and his friend Kareem with Yasser Arafat. They came to perform for him. This is the school. This is near the beginning of the school. That's the entrance. There's Ramzi and his wife now, not at the time, but now Celine in the black with her arms folded. This is a great story. This is the opening night of Al-Kamajati. they shipped the container of musical instruments from France, donated from people from all over Europe and the States, and it came in a semi-truck, and it was packed with foam and all of these plastic bags with shredded pieces of paper stuffed in the bags. They put the bags in the dumpster, but the kids found the bags and they dumped them all out. On the opening night, everybody said, you know, it looked like snow in Palestine in August of 2005.
Awesome.
Another picture taken by yours truly. This is what the Palestinians call the chicken plucking machine. It is the barrier between Bethlehem and Jerusalem. There's Ramzi with Oday, who is one of the star singers of Al-Kamanjati, who is a big character in the book. The first summer camp in a Ottoman palace built in 1820. And you could get up on the roof and see all of the hills of Palestine and the settlements and all the different lights at night, the lights of the settlement, of the military installations, and of the Palestinian villages. There's Celine again with some of the kids. This is a place called Sebastia, which is an ancient city from Roman times, and this an ancient Palestinian city, and people living there, you know, going back to before Christ. And this is the ruins of an amphitheater where Al-Kamanjati and Oday sang, and there were all these bands, and there was some French beatboxers playing, you know, and doing like iPhone loops and stuff, which is probably the only time that ever happened in that particular. Another image of confinement, men, young men waiting to work as day laborers before heading into Israel. This is Fadi Basha, who is a soprano, not anymore probably. This was taken, I think, in maybe 2011. He just, myself included, brought adults to tears with the power of his voice. Really an amazing kid. He learned Seben Crudeli, which I'm not pronouncing it right. It's an Italian aria, I think also composed in like 1820, in I think one lesson or one afternoon. And he sang it in unaccented Italian. And he told me once that he sang it in Bethlehem, and all these people from the Italian consulate came running up to him and started talking to him in Italian. He's like, I don't understand you.
Really good at singing it.
That's his teacher, Julia Caterina, who cut off her own opera career in the UK to teach voice lessons to these kids and Fadi and others. Ramzi on stage in France with Oday. He's, I think, 14 years old. He was so terrified of being in France, and he stuck to like the things he knew, like blackberry jam and labneh, which is a great delicacy. It's a kind of a yogurt in the consistency of cream cheese, but he hated things like the stinky blue cheese that they have in France. You know? There's Allah before she started wearing hijab at a younger age, taken by her father. This is, I think, in Toulouse, France. Benjamin Payen, a French violinist, teaching a young future symphonic celebrity. This is a story that is told in the book of there's some intolerance in the communities. Somebody didn't like the idea that boys and girls were studying together. And the Jenin School was opened by Ramzi, a branch of Al-Kamanjati, and someone set it on fire one night. No one was hurt, and the kids went out the next day, and they played in the open, and they said, nobody's going to stop us, and they built another school that was even better than before, and no one's bothered them since. This is in right along the West Bank Israeli border in this beautiful village called Batir, one of the few places along the border between Israel and the West Bank that does not have a wall. And as a result, you know, there's lots of beautiful light. Not the case for so many of the places right alongside the wall and the so-called security fence, which is actually where it's not a wall. It's a series of fences and trenches and barbed wire. This is, they're playing Mozart in the late afternoon. This is the son, or this is the widow of one of the best friend of the clarinet player who was shot last summer and killed while Israel made incursions into Ramallah, and that's her, the widow, and her son. This is Shahada, who we talked about, the instrument maker and his wares, his workshop. There's Celine, Ramzi's wife, who's Christian Lebanese, grew up partly in Lebanon, and then when the Civil War got really bad at age 8, her parents moved her and her sisters to France. And another girl in Rapture with a violin. And another mourning last summer in Gaza. Allah, the cover girl of the book, Allah Shalalda, that's probably taken last summer in Palestine in 2014, most likely. And this is Ramzi learned to a green thumb from his grandfather. He used to go on with his grandfather telling about, he taught him basically how to plant. And in his own home, it's just surrounded by a green everywhere. And he had this idea, and I think others there, of putting flowers in a violin case.
Nice. I'm just going to, a couple more questions.
Yes.
We'll definitely open it up to everyone. Yes, very great.
Thanks.
You know, with your previous project, one that I was so fond of because it started as a public radio project, it was The Lemon Tree, where you really looked at this conflict from, quote-unquote, both sides.
Yes.
You tried to tell it sort of from both perspectives. Basically, a house that had once belonged to a Palestinian family. They were left. They were left or were forced out. And then the Israeli family that came to occupy the house and the story of both the families and how those two families then were able to contact each other. It's a really amazing story.
Thanks.
And with this project, it's different, right? You decided to sort of take on one perspective.
Yeah.
And with this conflict, that's a difficult thing to do sometimes because everybody's got their opinions about what this conflict is and what it should be and how you should think. And
people tend to have strong opinions.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And that's fine. I just wonder, I guess I want to hear why you decided to do that and this time and do it that way.
I mean, a couple reasons. One is the story. I mean, the story that I told at the beginning and getting connected with Ramzi's history, to me, was sort of an amazing opportunity to tell a deeper part of the story that Americans and many other people don't really know. When I first started writing, when I went in the summer of 2010 and I came back to where I used to live, Gloucester, Massachusetts, and I wrote my book proposal and sent it off to my agent, and some friends said, how'd you like to do a reading, the work in progress? And I said, yeah, sure, of course. So I read it. And somebody came up to me afterwards, and she said, well, you know, can't you find a young Jewish violinist, an Israeli violinist, and tell his story and Ramzi's story? And I said, no. I mean, not that I could not. And it's certainly, Daniel Barenboim is a very large presence in his sort of, he's a moral presence in the book. So it wasn't like, oh, I'm not interested, but it was like this story about how this one young man grew up as a refugee, had a dream, you know, then goes off and then begins to understand how he can protect his people. It's a particular story, right? And so, you know, sometimes my students at USC will say, well, do I need, you know, all sides? Well, not of every story. It just depends on what story you're telling. I mean, that said, like, I have been hyper aware not only of how passionate people are about this, but, you know, a third or a quarter of the book is notes. And so, when I zoom out to tell about the history, I try to have that more even-handed. I mean, I'm telling the story from a Palestinian point of view when it's Palestinians who are experiencing something. But when I'm telling the larger story, I try to put a somewhat broader context on it. And if I'm saying something, I mean, one of the reasons there's so many notes in the book is because I get curious about something and I'll say, oh, maybe you'd like to know all about how trauma affects kids in war zones and how music can heal that. Well, I can't put that all in the book. I'll just park all this in the notes. But then there's other things, like there's a whole question about how much does the security fence, as Rizzo calls it, or the apartheid wall, or I call it the separation barrier, how much has that actually been the main reason for the decline in suicide attacks? There's a very nuanced discussion about how much that's true, and I get into it in the book, but if I don't back that up, you know, with like multiple sources, including Israeli people in the intelligence, saying this has not, you know, been as big of a difference maker as many people have come to believe. You have to back that up. So I'm sort of, I feel anyway, that I'm on the side of the reader. Like if somebody's going to be skeptical, you know, you look on the notes for page 278 and you might have more notes than you have in the original paragraph.
And there's something to be said too for just telling the story of someone's everyday life. You know, I mean, part of going through Ramsey's story is just feeling what it feels like to live in the West Bank.
Yes. You know? Yeah. And thank you for saying that, because that's really as much as anything.
News reporters can't do that. That's not our mission.
Right.
It's not our charge day in and day out.
Right.
Just give you a sense of what it feels like.
Yeah.
To be on one side or the other of something.
Yeah. And I feel like, you know, we in the U.S., more or less, Jew or Gentile, are raised with what I call the Leon Uris history, as told in Exodus, that the story is the heroic birth of Israel out of the ashes of the Holocaust, which is a powerful truth, but a terribly incomplete one if you want to tell the story of the peoples. And so that's sort of what the Lemon Tree was about. But I also feel like people really don't know what it's like to live under occupation. What I call the Uber narrative, with many fine exceptions of the coverage here, is Israel needs to be secure. Israelis need to be secure. And few people would argue with that. But what about the Palestinians? Do they also have the right to be secure and to be free? And what if we broadened the conversation, which is sort of the thing most of all that I would like to contribute to, broaden and deepen the conversation to include what it's like to feel your life under occupation.
Mm-hmm. There's one, you know, the final scene of the book, it's actually a scene that's kind of peppered throughout. I don't want to give too much away, but it's musicians Palestinian musicians who have to get to Jerusalem to play a concert.
Yeah.
And some of them have permits, and some of them don't.
Right.
And in order to get there, these guys basically have to get to go to a concert that they are performing in their you know, like they're on the presumably on the program, right, to perform this, but they can't actually get to where they have to go, so they have to hire a smuggler and then climb over a wall and drop, you know, the violin case down just to get to Jerusalem. And they finally make it, and there's a sense of hope at the end because they make it and they've kind of pulled one over on folks. But there's also, you know, as so often with this story, that's so sad, you know. And I think there are times in the book where I feel I was reading it and felt so hopeful when I felt that the music was protecting these youngsters. But there are times when I found myself completely sobbing at how grim the situation just has become. That it's still, that you have to trick somebody to be able to go play a concert. You know, I mean, because what you do in this book is you also track the many attempts at peace processes and the, you know, the further incursions into the West Bank by the Israeli military. And it's not a happy story. Was that hard for you, I guess, to write about sometimes?
I mean, sometimes. I mean, I felt so lucky and fortunate to have found this story and refound Ramsey, in a sense, because, you know, at the time, I had actually just come back from the South Hebron Hills, where I'd interviewed a 13-year-old girl who described being stoned by settlers on her way to school. German shepherds were set upon the children sometimes. And eggs were thrown at them. And it was just so grim. And, you know, and I thought, you know, and then I meet Ramsey. And he's like, come to my school. And the school is beautiful. And what he's trying to do is beautiful.
Right.
And, you know, there's problems with the school and you know, I mean, we could talk about all kinds of problems within, you know, the Palestinian society as well. But,
sure.
I mean, what's happened is that he's given lots and lots of people hope. But it's true. I mean, every time in the last probably 10 years that I've been getting ready to go back, and I did live there for the summer of 2011, and I spent, you know, a month here, 3 months there, a few weeks here. But right around a few days before I get ready to go, And I you know, maybe not the last time, but I mean, for years this would happen. I'd start getting this sort of anxious feeling, not because I felt in danger, but because of the sadness, because of the confinement and the hatred and the animosity and the tension, you know, and it's just a lot. I mean, you know, as a journalist, you want to be open, right? But if you're, I mean, you've, in some of your own brilliant work and the personal work you've done for public radio, know better than I or as well how this can affect you. If you're totally open, you could just get mauled, you get destroyed by yourself because you just get, it's, if you're totally open, you can lose yourself. And if you close up, you know, people drink hard or they become cynical and they're not open to the story. So it's that balance. It's like putting a screen on you, you know, where you don't let the flood come in, but you don't close yourself out to the story. So that's always been a thing to navigate for me.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I want to ask you a million more questions, but I feel like we should give some opportunities to everyone out here. And just, yeah, please do keep it to a question. That's all we ask. And we'd love to hear from you. Go ahead. Yep.
Hi, I want to thank you for writing the book, but is Ramses in any danger of death threats?
I would say no. He has received threats in the past. I mentioned this incident of the fire. I believe the fire was 2009, if I'm not mistaken. And I've been there probably 5 times with him. You know, anything can happen at any time. But I think Al-Khamenejati is now really seen as a kind of ambassador for Palestine. It's very widely respected. There have been some people who maybe initially didn't understand, you know, what they were doing. Is this foreigners who are behind it? Rumors go around. It's almost sort of like a village-level thing that can happen where there's petty jealousies. That's what he thought the fire was about, not so much of an Islamist thing. No one ever really found out who did that. But I would say, generally speaking, to your question, the answer is no. Not that he hasn't had threats in the past, but I would say generally no.
Hi, Sandy. Great to see you.
Hi, Sonia.
Hi.
This is a student from Berkeley. Nice
Hi.
To see you.
It's been a long time. So, Sandy, I just wanted to ask you how you sort of, I know you've spent extensive amounts of time in Ramallah and the West Bank, and as a journalist, how do you go about navigating a culture that's starkly different than your own, and then garnering the trust of the musicians? You know, it seems like Ramzi was very open and accessible, but the other musicians and their families, especially coming from the West, how do you sort of garner their trust so that they open up and sort of navigate that?
Well, it's a challenge that's mostly met by time. I had the luxury of time. And I had written The Lemon Tree before, and although my Arabic is well, not non-existent, but I, you know, my vocabulary is limited to a few hundred words, and so I'm always working, if people don't speak English, with translators. But I think, you know, one universal thing no matter where you are, I don't know if you would agree with this, Kelly, but you know, if people sense a sincerity and a curiosity and a willingness to share a little bit about your history, then I think there's a certain openness that comes. And you know, Palestinian society, as many people do not know, and a lot of the rest of Arab society, is very welcoming. You know, I was married to a Palestinian for 8 years, and you know, you used to get so many invitations, and like you'd have to like start, you know, saying, no, I have already eaten 6 times today, you know, and so, you know, so there's this sense of hospitality. And so when you get an invitation, like in Shahada and Allah and Rasha's parents invited me for Ramadan feast after sundown, called the iftar, and it was such an honor. And then I went and got some dates, you know, which is what the Prophet ate, 2 dates at the beginning of the end of his fast, or the beginning when the fast ends, rather. And So I went through, and there were these date, you know, big date branches, right? And you'd cut them, and there were like white dates and black dates and purple dates. And I was telling you, I'm getting invited to iftar dinner, and the shop owners are like, "Yeah, ooh, this is a really nice shape, isn't it?" You know, and you get, and then you bring it, and then there's a sense of exchange, and through those kinds of things, there's trust. And I think, as much as anything, it's just repeating the time over and over again. And then people realize that you're serious about it and you're really curious. And then after a while, they get tired of all your questions. I don't know what color my shirt was 10 years ago, you know. But you want to, you know, you want to tell, get all the details right as much as possible, or just not write a detail, obviously not make one up.
Thank you, Sarita. That git fiddle looking instrument, what's the name of it, sir?
What? Say that again?
The instruments that were shown in the burned incident.
Those are ouds.
Thank you, sir.
It's basically the predecessor, as I understand. I'm not an expert, but I believe it's the predecessor of the guitar. It's more of a bulbous shape, and it's very prevalent all the way from Armenia, Greece, and the Arab world.
I heard you this morning on the radio and on KPFK with Beto Arcos,
uh-huh.
Global Village, and I found that really fascinating. That's where I came and brought my nephew to this lecture. Would you please talk about the? There was a moment in this morning's show, and I recommend the archive for anybody that's interested, where you mentioned how he came across the flight of the bumblebee, and how you were, you know, can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So in the book and in the first Ramzi program I did for NPR in 98, he was describing, you know, I wanted to try to combine the music with the sense of what it was like when he was running from the soldiers during the first Intifada in 88, 89. And he said, you know, you should put this with Flight of the Bumblebee, because he heard his first viola teacher was a guy named Peter Solsky, was in the London Symphony Orchestra. He grew up in Worcester, Mass, American guy. And he said he heard Peter play it once when he was like 18, 19. He's like, he closed his eyes, he swore there were three people playing, you know, and he said, I have to learn that. And then when he started playing it, he said, this reminded me of running from the soldiers, because it's very frenetic. You know, I'm not going to try to hum it, or I'd be really, people would leave really quickly. But in the documentary that I did in the piece for NPR 98, I combined that. We played a little excerpt from that this morning. But that was sort of where there's sort of life and music is sort of fused in that sense. It was he that recommended that.
Does Ramses have children? Are they into music?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Does Ramses have children and are they into music?
Oh, does Ramzi have children? Yes, he and Celine have two children. Hussein was born in 2009, so he'll be six. Let's see. Yeah, he'll be six this June, and then they have Adam, who's I think two. Or three, I think it's two. I don't think they've yet gotten into music, but I wouldn't be surprised if a musical education is in store for them. They certainly have lots of instruments to choose from.
They have a choice.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hello.
You mentioned that the school is now becoming like a symbol of Palestine and a point of pride, mm-hmm. and I'm curious whether this status and the additional status it's going to probably be granted as a result of your book is going to make it easier in terms of like crossing checkpoints, doing a concert in Israel, or is it going to make it more difficult if the current administration is trying to suppress all the Palestinian identity, or how you see that unfolding in the future?
Well, I you know, I would like this book to make, you know, a positive impact, but I can't imagine that the permit regime will be affected whatsoever by my book and whatever, you know, additional notoriety that Al-Khamenejati gets. I mean, Ramzi is able to come and go from Palestine, from the West Bank to Europe and back in the Arab world, and he's gotten visas to come to the States. It's Jerusalem that's harder. I mean, people, Palestinians, you know, sort of dark humor, they say it's easier to go to China than it is to go to Jerusalem. And it's actually true for a lot of people. So, but I don't think that my book will necessarily make any difference in that sense, because I don't think people, you know, I don't think the people who make these decisions are probably going to read my book, or if they do, they probably won't let it affect them one way or another.
Hey, Sandy, I wonder, in talking to Ramzi, does he have a sense, or do you know if he feels any sense of optimism or pessimism about the future of the situation there, whether things are ever going to get better, or whether they're so entrenched and there's so much hatred on both sides that he feels it may be, it may never be resolved?
Well, he's, you know, he wants to go home to his village, even though his village doesn't exist. We talked a little bit about that before. He wants to build something on the land that his grandparents left in 48. And he sees, so in that sense, he's sort of an optimist that someday we'll be able to go back to our homes and everybody will be able to live on this land together. You know, so in the long term, I think he's maybe an optimist. In the immediate term, I think he's not an optimist. There was a guy named Emil Habibi who wrote a famous book called The Pessimist. And I think there are a lot of Palestinians who consider themselves pessimists. but I think, you know, one of the sources of optimism among many Palestinians now is certainly not, you know, the ongoing situation on the ground, but the sense that the path to the two-state solution has been pretty much exhausted, and especially when Netanyahu, despite his attempts to kind of retract himself post-election, has essentially said, in many ways, actually, before the famous statement, he said it back in July, that there's not going to be any Palestinian state. This gives fuel to what's known as the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, which is a nonviolent direct confrontation of Israel. Many people feel like this is not the way to go. And then they're, you know, the people answer, well, then what would you suggest? Because the situation keeps getting worse and the peace process hasn't worked. So the idea being that if there's an attempt to bring Israel to answer to the occupation, that maybe there'll be enough attention given to, you know, another way of coming to a realization that really what you have in Palestine and Israel now is essentially a one-state reality, militarily controlled in the West Bank and really Gaza from the air and from the sea and from the borders, where one people has a series of rights and another does not.
This is our last question. Whoever's got it, okay.
It's so sad to hear what's going on there. And it reminds me of apartheid in South Africa, this ghettoization of peoples and a power taking over another. In the apartheid movement, there was a great many young people, mostly young people, but white people who are Afrikaners who took the position of being on the side of the oppressed people there, the oppressed native South Africans, and came to their aid, helped them, lawyers, all kinds of things. Do the Palestinians have that on the other side, on the Israeli side, on the settlement side? Are there people there who are standing up for them, who are Jewish, who are standing up for them, and who are letting, do they know that these people exist? Are there people that are giving them hope?
Yes, there are. Although it's increasingly difficult for people to even meet because of the wall, because of the permit restrictions, because of the checkpoints themselves, it's illegal for Israeli citizens to go to the West Bank, generally speaking. So it's very difficult for there to be that sort of contact. And that is lessened already by the sense that this whole, by Palestinians, that this whole dialogue, Oslo era, didn't work. But there are progressive Israelis, Daniel Barenboim being one of them, who stand in witness to what's happening. There's also something called the International Solidarity Movement and others in Europe and the U.S. that have come to sort of bear witness. The whole notion of apartheid is somewhat less, we were talking about this at dinner, I mean, somewhat less controversial to use that phrase in relationship to the reality that Palestinians are living under. When Jimmy Carter came out with his book, Israel, Peace or Apartheid, people just, you know, he lost funding for his Carter Center. There was a huge controversy, even though Desmond Tutu himself compared the situation to apartheid as early as 2002. You know, I haven't gotten caught up in, like, because, you know, it's a failed analogy in some ways. There are similarities in other. If you see a checkpoint and there's, like, a line for settlers and a line for Palestinians, well, what are you going to think? How about Jim Crow? I mean, that's not a perfect analogy either. To me, it's not so much it's this or it's not this or it's that or it's not that. It's like, what is the reality? And can we open ourselves to what's happening on the ground? And there are, to answer your question, people who are witness to that.
Well, I think we should give a round of applause to Sandy Cohen.
Thank you, Kelly. Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this story.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.